Hello and welcome to the podcast. This is Ron's Amazing Stories, where we play tales to take you away from today. On the podcast today, we finally have reached the incredible 24-minute conclusion to our journey called Anything You Can Do by Randall Garrett. Joining us on the podcast today is Mark Nelson, who's been reading that very same story. And I have to say, I've been looking forward to the end and talking to Mark. Later in the program, Tom Williams is back with a story he simply calls Those Tom Sawyer Days. So let's get to it right now. I wanted to take a minute and remind you that I am looking for your stories. In fact, I'm in need of your Christmas stories. I want scary, strange, or unusual tales, and they don't even have to be true. That's right, original fiction is just fine. If you tell it and I can use it, I will read it or you can yourself. To find out more, read this week's blog or go to ronsamazingstories.com. There you'll find a banner called Story Submissions. Click on it and fill it in with your story or set up a time for us to chat. Whatever you do, please tell your tale. We want to hear it. And now, let's get to that final chapter with Bart and the Knife. On July 5th, 2018, three amazing things came together. First, we played episode number 335 of Ron's Amazing Stories. And on that podcast, we debuted our book, written by Randall Garrett, called Anything You Can Do. Now, I'll bet you're wondering what the third thing is. On that very show, I had the pleasure of interviewing Mark Nelson. Mark is a professional narrator and just happens to be the person that has been reading you Anything You Can Do over the last few months. He has done an exceptional job, and I thought, who better to close out the book than Mark himself? So, I want to welcome to the RAS, Mark Nelson. He's here to introduce and give us his thoughts on our novel. Welcome back, Mark.
Thanks. Glad to be back.
Yeah, I guess it's your second time. I got to tell you right off the bat, the comments that I get have ranged from you're absolutely the best narrator on the planet to he made me feel the story and I really appreciate what Mark has done.
Wow.
You have done a tremendous job thus far on the story. You have really brought it home. How you created the characters and gave them feeling for Bart and one for Martin and another for Colonel Mannheim and Dr. Farnsworth and Yoritomo. And you just absolutely gave each one life. And I want to compliment you on that right away.
Well, thanks. I'm glad it worked.
It did. Before we get to the epic conclusion, I know everybody's chomping at the bit to do that, but why don't we just kind of go through what's happened so far? So maybe somebody, this is their first time, and they can kind of know what's happened so far.
Okay.
I'll start it out and say this, that, the Knipe, he's an alien. He's from another world. His ship was damaged by our Earth's sun. And knowing that his meager supplies weren't going to see him through, he safely crashed land on Earth after eating his very own brother. You want to take the next segment there?
Okay, so he crash lands in Siberia. After killing a park ranger, he makes his way to a mental hospital in Leningrad, I think.
Yep.
He has taught himself to speak Russian. After talking to the locals for a bit, he has this freak out, kills them all, steals a flyer, and flies to what is Manhattan, where he's been hiding out for like 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
Under close supervision of the U.S. government, or the world government then, who know he's there. He sneaks out periodically to find supplies to do something. Nobody's quite sure what it's going to be. And in the process, keeps killing and eating Earth people. And he can be anywhere from New York to Miami. He just pops up out of nowhere. He kills, he steals, and he's gone.
During this, we've had these little interludes about these two twin boys. And they are Bart Stanton and Martin Stanton. Yes. We're hearing the story about how poor Martin was with his father at work one day, and there was, some sort of atomic explosion, and he is injured severely. And over time, he loses even the ability to react to people around him. He becomes kind of a vegetable, sort of. Bart, of course, he loves his brother, and they grow up together, and with Bart overseeing and helping take care of Mart.
Okay. Then we flash forward, and we find that Bart Stanton is an experiment in a project to deal with the Nipe. Instead of trying to kill the Nipe, they want to somehow make contact with him, and for some reason, they've got to have a Superman. So a Dr. Yoritomo, under the auspices of a Colonel Mannheim, have this project where they're creating a Superman out of Bart Stanton for eventual showdown with the Nipe.
Then we find out that there is a detective named Martin Stanley. He's considered the greatest detective of the asteroid belts, has made just an incredible name for himself, respected, absolute genius. And what we find out is that they try to enlist him to help him with the Nipe, but he isn't having any of it. He doesn't want to have a thing to do with the Nipe. And we never really understand why until
Colonel Mannheim is killed and eaten by the Nipe in full view of all of his guards, who were told to stand down and just basically watch it happen. Then we find that Mart Stanley is his backup and is flying from the asteroid belt to Earth to take over the project, and is, of course, the long-lost twin brother.
But it takes another turn, and we find out that Bart is actually Martin, who is the genetically engineered Superman to deal with the Nipe, and Bart is actually the detective who had been hypnotized for the last 10 years into believing that he was Martin Stanley.
Dr. Yoritomo has informed the quote-unquote Bart Stanton that he's going to be confronting the Nipe within a matter of days.
Probably at the most exciting moment, Bart himself is standing in front of the Nipe, and they're facing each other for the very first time. We know the story. What are your bets? Do you think that Bart has what it takes to take the Nipe, or are you on the side of the Nipe, who is just too powerful and too fast that Bart can't handle it? What do you think, Mark?
What do I think? Well, I mean, after all, I have read the book twice. So that gives me a little bit of an advantage, but I'm calling it a draw.
A draw.
A draw.
You know what I'm going to go with? I'm sorry, Ed. I think that Bart is going to have to kill the Nipe. I that's just what I think. It's going to be a sad thing because of all the people that gave their lives for this. I just think that's what's going to happen. So what do you think, Mark? Shall we listen to the last 24 minutes?
It's time for the conclusion of Anything You Can Do by Randall Garrett. The quality of the illumination at the head of the stairs was different from that which he had been used to for the past 3 hours. He lifted off the infrared goggles. Enough light spilled over from the Nipe's lair to give him illumination to see by. Silently, he put the goggles on the floor of the platform. He wouldn't need them again. Then, step by step, he walked up the concrete stairway. At the head of the stairs, he paused to get his bearings. The illumination was not bright, but it was enough to...
Barbell, he's heard you. Watch it!
But Stanton had already heard the movement of the Nipe. He jerked off the communicator and threw it down the stairs behind him. He wanted no encumbrances now. He ran quickly out into the center of the big underground room, away from the open stairwell.
and then, as fast as any express train that had ever moved through these subterranean ways, the Knipe came around a corner 30 feet away, his four violet eyes gleaming, his limbs rippling beneath his centipede-like body. From 15 feet away, he launched himself through the air, his outstretched hands ready to kill. But Stanton's marvelous neuromuscular system was already in action. At this stage of the game, it would be utter suicide to let the Knipe get in close. Stanton couldn't fend off 8 grasping hands with his own 2. He leapt to one side, and the Knipe got his first surprise in 10 years, when Stanton's fist slammed against the side of his snouted head, knocking him in the direction opposite that in which Stanton had moved. The Knipe landed, turned, and charged back toward the man. This time he reared up, using his 2 rearmost pairs of limbs for locomotion, while the 2 forward pairs were held out, ready to kill. He got surprise number 2 when Stanton's fist landed on the tip of his rather sensitive snout, rocking his head back. His own hands met nothing but air, and by the time he had recovered from the blow, Stanton was well back, out of the way. "He's so small," Stanton thought wonderingly. Even when he reared up, the Knipe's head was only 3 feet above the concrete floor. The Knipe came in again, more cautiously this time. Stanton punched again with a straight right. The Knipe moved his head aside, and Stanton's knuckles merely grazed the side of the alien's head, just below the lower right eye. At the same time, one of the Knipe's hands swung in a chopping right hook that took Stanton just below the ribs. Stanton leapt back with a gasp of pain. The Knipe didn't use fists. He used his open hand, fingers together, like a judo fighter. The Knipe came forward, and, as Stanton danced back, the Knipe made a grab for his ankle, almost catching it. There were too many hands to watch. Stanton had 2 advantages, weight and reach. His arms were almost half again as long as the Knipe's. Against that, the Knipe had all those hands, and with his low center of gravity and 4-footed stance, it would be hard to knock him down. On the other hand, if Stanton lost his footing, the fight would be over fast. Stanton lunged suddenly forward and planted a left in the Knipe's right upper eye, then followed it with a right uppercut to the Knipe's jaw as his head snapped back. The Knipe's 4 hands cut inward from the sides like sword blades, but they found no target. Backing away, Stanton realized he had another advantage. The Knipe couldn't throw a straight jab. His shoulders, if that's what they should be called, were narrow, and the upper arm bones weren't articulated properly for such a blow. The alien could throw a mean hook, but he had to get in close to deliver it. On the other side of the coin was the fact that the Knipe knew plenty about human anatomy, from the bones out. Stanton's knowledge of the Knipe anatomy was almost totally superficial. He wished he knew if and where the Knipe had a solar plexus. He would like to punch something soft for a change. Instead, he tried for another eye. He danced in, jabbed, and danced out. The Knipe had ducked again, taking the blow on the side of his head. Then the Knipe came in low, at an angle, trying for the groin. For his troubles, he got a knee in the jaw that staggered him badly. One grasping hand clutched at Stanton's right thigh and grabbed hard. Stanton swung his fist down like a pendulum and knocked the arm aside. But there was a slight limp in his movements as he backpedaled away from the Knipe. That full-handed pinch had hurt like the very devil. Stanton was angry now, with the hot, controlled anger of a fighting man. He stepped in quickly and slammed 2 fast, hard jabs into the point of the Knipe's snout, jarring the monster backward. And this time it was the Knipe who scuttled back out of the way. Stanton moved in fast to press his advantage and landed a butte on the Knipe's lower left eye. Then he tried a body blow. It wasn't too successful. The alien had an endoskeleton, but he also had a tough hide that was somewhat like thick, leathery chitin. Staden pulled back, getting out of the way of the Knipe's open-handed judo cuts. His fists were beginning to hurt, and his leg was paining him badly where the Knipe had clamped onto it, and his ribs were throbbing where the Knipe had landed that single blow. And then he realized that, so far, the Knipe had only landed that one blow. One punch and one pinch, Stanton thought with a touch of awe. The only other damage he's inflicted has been to my knuckles. The Knipe charged in again. Then he leapt suddenly and clawed for Stanton's face with his first pair of hands. The second and third pairs chopped in toward the man's body. The last pair propelled him off the floor. Stanton stepped back and drove in a long, hard right, hitting him just below the jaw, where his throat would have been if he had been human. The Knipe arced backward in a half-somersault and landed flat on his back. Stanton backed up a little more, waiting, while the Knipe wiggled feebly for a moment. The Marquis of Queensberry should have lived to see this, he thought. The Knipe rolled over and crouched on all eight limbs. His violet eyes watched Stanton, but the man could read no expression on that inhuman face.
"You did not kill."
For a moment, Stanton found it hard to believe that the hissing, guttural voice had come from the crouching monster.
"You did not even try to kill."
"I have no wish to kill you," Stanton said evenly.
"I can see that. Do you? Are you?"
He stopped, as if baffled.
"There are not the proper words. Do you follow the customs?"
Stanton felt a surge of triumph. This was what George Yoritomo had guessed might happen. "If I must kill you," Stanton said carefully, "I myself will do the honors. You will not go uneaten." The Knipe sagged a little, relaxing all over.
"I had hoped it was so. It was the only thinkable thing. I saw you on the television, and it was only thinkable that you came for me."
Stanton sighed inwardly. That part of Colonel Mannheim's strategy had worked too. The Knipe had seen all the publicity releases that had been so carefully tailored for him.
"I knew you were out on the asteroids," the Knipe went on. "But I had decided that you had come to kill. Since you did not, what are your thoughts, Stanley Martin?"
"That we should help each other," Stanton said. It was as simple as that. Stanton sat in his hotel room, smoking a cigarette, staring at the wall and thinking. He was alone again. All the fuss and feathers and foo-farah were over. Dr. Farnsworth was in another room of the suite, making his plans for a complete physical examination of the Knipe. Dr. George Yoritomo was having the time of his life, holding a conversation with the Knipe, drawing the alien out, and getting him to talk about his own race and their history. And Stanley Martin was plotting the next phase of the capture, the cover-up. Stanton smiled a little. Colonel Mannheim had been a great one for planning, all right. Every little detail was taken care of. It had sometimes made his plans more complex than necessary, Stanton suspected. Mannheim had tended to try to account for every possible eventuality, and after he had done that, he had set aside a few reserves here and there just in case they might be useful if something unforeseen happened. All things considered, the government had certainly done the right thing. And in picking Mannheim, they had picked the right man. Stanton got up, walked over to the window, and looked down at the streets of Government City, eight floors below. What would those people down there think if they were told the true story of the Knipe? What would the average citizen say if he discovered that, at this very moment, the Knipe was being treated almost as an honored guest of the government? More, what would he say if he suspected that the Knipe, the horrible, murderous, man-eating Knipe, could have been killed easily at any time during the past 6 years? Would it be possible for anyone to explain to the common average man that, in the long run,
the knowledge possessed by the Nipe was tremendously more valuable to the race of man than the lives of a few individuals. Could those people down there, and the others like them all over the world, be made to understand that, by his own lights, the Nipe had been behaving in the most civilized and gentlemanly fashion he knew? Could they ever be made to understand that, because of the tremendous wealth of priceless information stored in that alien brain, the Nipe's life had to be preserved at any cost? Or would they scream for blood? Dr. Farnsworth assumed that Stanley Martin was going to spread a story about the Nipe's death, a carefully concocted story about how Stanley Martin had found the beast and the police had killed it. There might, Farnsworth assumed, be a carefully made corpse for the mob to hiss at. Maybe Farnsworth was right. But Stanton had the feeling that Martin and George Yoritomo had something else up their collective sleeve. The phone hummed. Stanton walked over, thumbed the answer button, and watched George Yoritomo's face take shape on the screen. "Bart, I have just had the privilege of viewing the tapes of your fight with our friend the Nipe. Incredible! I watched the original on the screen, of course, but I had to run the tapes. I wanted to slow it down so that I could see what actually happened. Magnificent, that right of yours! So!" He jabbed a fist out, shadow-boxing with Stanton over the phone circuit. "Aw, it weren't nothing, Ma," Stanton drawled. "I just sort of flang out a fist and he got in the way." "Of course, but such a fling! Seriously, Bart, I want to run those tapes over again, and I want you to tell me, as best you can, just what went on in your mind at each stage of the fight. It will be most informative." "You mean right now? I have an appointment." Yoritomo waved a hand. "No, no, later. Take your time. But I am honestly amazed that you won so easily. I knew you were good, and I was certain you'd win, but I must admit that I honestly expected you to be injured." Stanton looked down at his bandaged hands and felt the ache of his broken rib and the pain of the blue bruise on his thigh. In spite of the way it looked, he had actually been hurt worse than the Nipe had. That boy was tough. "The trouble was that he couldn't adapt himself to fighting in a new way, just as you predicted," he told Yoritomo. "He fought me, I assume, in just the way he would have fought another Nipe, and that didn't work. I had the reach on him, and I could maneuver faster. Besides, he can't throw a straight punch with those shoulders of his." "It appeared to me," Yoritomo said with a broad grin, "that you were fighting him as you would fight another human being, eh?" Stanton grinned back. "I was, in a modified way. But I wasn't confined to a pattern. Besides, I won, the Nipe didn't, and that's all that counts." "It is indeed. Well, I'll let you know when I'm ready for your impressions of the fight. Probably tomorrow sometime, say in the afternoon?" "Fine." George Yoritomo nodded his thanks and his image collapsed and faded from the screen. Stanton walked back over to the window, but this time he looked at the horizon, not the street. George Yoritomo had called him Bart. It's funny, Stanton thought, how habit can get the best of a man. Yoritomo had known the truth all along, and now he knew that his pupil, or patient, whichever it was aware of the truth. And still, he had called him Bart. "And I still think of myself as Bart," he thought. "I probably always will." And why not? Why shouldn't he? Martin Stanton no longer existed. In a sense, he had never existed. And in actual fact, he had never had much of a real existence. He was only a bad dream. He had always been a bad dream. And now that the dream was over, only Bart was real. He thought back, remembering George Yoritomo's explanation. "Take two people," he had said, "two people genetically identical. Damage one of them so badly that he is helpless and useless, to himself and to others. Damage him so badly that he is always only a step away from death." The vague telepathic bond that always links identical twins, they think alike, they say, becomes unbalanced under such conditions. Normally, there is a give and take. One mind is as strong as the other, and each preserves the sense of his own identity, since the two different sets of sense receptors give different viewpoints. But if one of the twins is damaged badly enough, then something must happen to that telepathic linkage. Usually, it is broken. But the link between you and your brother was not broken. Instead, it became a one-way channel. What happens in such a case? The damaged brother, in order to escape the intolerable prison of his own body, becomes a receptor for the stronger brother's thoughts. The weaker feels as the stronger feels. The experience of the one becomes the experience of the other. The thrill of running after a baseball, the pride of doing something clever with the hands, the touch of a girl's kiss upon the lips, all these become the property of the weaker, since he is receiving the thoughts of the stronger. There is, of course, no flow in the other direction. The stronger brother has no way of knowing that his every thought is being duplicated in his brother's mind. In effect, the damaged brother ceases to think. The thoughts in his mind are those of the healthy brother. The feeling of identity becomes almost complete. To the outside observer, the damaged brother appears to be a cataleptic schizophrenic, completely cut off from reality. And, in a sense, he is. Stanton walked over to the nightstand by the bed, took another cigarette from the pack, lit it, and looked at the smoke curling up from the tip. So Martin became a cataleptic schizophrenic, he thought. The mind of Martin had ceased to think at all. The Bart part of him had not wanted to be disturbed by the garbled, feeble sensory impression that Mart's body provided. Like many another schizophrenic, Martin had been living in a little world cut off from the actual physical world around his body. The difference between Martin's condition and that of the ordinary schizophrenic had been that Martin's little dream world had actually existed. It had been an almost exact counterpart of the world that had existed in the perfectly sane, rational mind of his brother, Bart. It had grown and developed as Bart had, fed by the one-way telepathic flow from the stronger mind to the weaker. There had been two Barts, and no Mart at all. But there had been only one human being between them. Bart Stanton had been a strong, capable, intelligent, active human being. The duplicate of his mind was just a recording in the mind of a useless, radiation-blasted hulk. And then the Neurophysical Institute had come into the picture. A new process had been developed by Dr. Farnsworth and his crew, by which a human being could be reconstructed, made literally into a Superman. All the techniques had been worked out in careful and minute detail. But there was one major drawback. Any normal human body would resist the process, to the death if necessary, just as a normal human body will resist a skin graft from an alien donor or the injection of an alien protein. But the radiation-damaged body of Martin Stanton had had no resistance of that kind. It had long been known that deep penetrating ionizing radiation had that effect on an organism. The ability to resist was weakened, almost destroyed. With Martin Stanton's body, perhaps the process might work. So Bartholomew Stanton, who had become Martin's legal guardian after the death of their mother, had given permission for the series of operations that would rebuild his crippled brother. The telepathic link, of course, had to be shut off, for a time at least. If it remained intact, Martin would never be able to think for himself, no matter what was done to his body. Part of that cutting-off process could be done during the treatment of Martin, but only if Bartholomew would cooperate. He had done his part. He had submitted to deep hypnosis, and had allowed himself to be convinced that his name was Stanley Martin, to think of himself as Stanley Martin. The Martin name was one that the real Martin's mind would reject utterly. The mind wanted nothing to do with anything named Martin. Stanley Martin, then, had gone out to the asteroids. In his mind had been implanted the further instructions that he was not to return to Earth, nor to attempt to investigate the NIPE under any circumstances. The simple change of name and environment had been just enough to snap the link during a time when Martin's brain had been inactivated by cold therapy and anesthetics. Only the sense of identity had remained. The patient was still Bart, but now he was being forced to think for himself. Mannheim had used them both, naturally. Colonel Mannheim had the ability to use anyone at hand, including himself, to get a job done. Stanton looked at his watch. It was almost time. Mannheim had sent for Stanley Martin when the time had come for him to return in order to give the NIPE data that he would be sure to misinterpret. A special series of code phrases in the message had released Stanley Martin from the hypnotic suggestions that had held him for so long. He knew now that he was Bartholomew Stanton. "And so do I," thought the man by the window. "We have a lot to straighten out, we two." There was a knock at the door. Stanton walked over and opened it, trying not to think. It was like looking into a mirror. "Hello, Bart," he said. "Hello, Bart," said the other. In that instant, complete telepathic linkage was restored. In that instant, they both knew what only one of them had known before, that for a time the telepathic flow had been one way again, but this time in the opposite direction, that Stanley Martin had been shaken that afternoon when his own mind had become the receptor for the other's thoughts, and he had experienced completely the entire battle with the NIPE. His release from the post-hypnotic suggestion had made it possible. There was no need for further words. Idiobus unum. There was unity without a loss of identity.
Well, I was wrong. You were right. I guess I should have gone with your gut instinct since you'd actually read the book. Were you surprised by that? It was an ingenious way of handling it.
Yes, but the thing is, you have to wonder, and what's great, one of the many great things about this book is it keeps you wondering all along, what is really happening? What's the real objective? The whole Mart Stanley in the asteroid belt just feels like this giant red herring. And then suddenly it all comes together and makes sense. You know why they did what they did to get the outcome that they were looking for, which was a partnership with the NIPE.
Well, and there was more to it than that, I think. I was looking at the morality of the whole thing. Allowing all of these people to be eaten, including Colonel Mannheim himself. Why? And if you think about it, I think it had far more reaching. I think that what he was going for here was save the planet, because you don't want an army of these things coming to Earth with the idea of eating everybody on the planet.
That would be uncomfortable. But they did seem to figure out along the way that what he was building was a communicator. So If he completed the communicator, he would call, we don't know if it would be a lifeboat or an army. And that's a legitimate concern. But of course, if you make him just go away, you take the chance that, well, maybe his people don't know where he is and we're all safe. But you don't know. They still might come looking for him.
And so having him there, understanding that they respected his ways, they also will have time. I'm sure it's going to take time for any kind of lifeboat to come pick him up. They will have the time to say, hey, this is really what our culture is all about. We're individuals, and you're more of a hive mind.
But we're friends.
But we're friends, and we can get along.
You don't have to attack. I'm fine. You know, we're partners here on out.
So let me ask you this. Why do you think it was important for them to hypnotize, brainwash Bart?
That's a good question. And I think it's because Dr. Yoritomo had to control his Superman very carefully and make sure that he was free of cultural opinions that would color his relationship with the NIPE. He had to get inside the Knipe's head, and during the course of their conversations, Yoritomo helps Bart Stanton not just deal with the physical thing he thinks he needs to do to be able to communicate with the Knipe, but get inside the Knipe's head. And I think the suggestion is, if he really did have this connected consciousness with his long-lost twin, that would get poisoned, and he would come in with preconceptions that would prevent him from doing what he had to do and only had one chance to do. That's my best guess.
That makes sense, because he had to risk his brother's life. Why would he allow that, knowing 5 years that they could go in and blow the thing up at any particular time, at any particular time they could have gone in and absolutely just destroyed the thing.
Yep.
And by keeping him brainwashed that whole time, he was anything that it seemed like anything to do with the Knipe. No, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to do it. And they made that very clear in the chapter that made no sense.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where we met the detective. We're going, why are they doing this? What is the purpose of this? Why are we even reading this?
Yeah, it seems like a divergence that's completely out of the blue.
And then we find out that was Garrett's purpose all along, to show us something's happening here, and I want you to be aware of it. Ingenious.
Yep. A very different story. And there was a lot of things that attracted me to doing this book. And as I recall, I think somebody sent me a suggestion, and which caused me to find the book and read it through. But you've got a whole bunch of things in it that you don't find in other sci-fi, certainly of that era, where the aliens are basically humans with blue hair. Here you've got something that's not only looks completely different from anything on our planet, it thinks completely and has a completely alien culture that we can't comprehend.
I agree. I had not heard of Randall Garrett, actually. I knew him under a different name, Gerald Vance. Some of the work that he did as writing as Gerald Vance, I was very familiar with that. But I had never heard of Randall Garrett. And now I'm starting to see the similarities between the two and the fact of what he was able to do with his characters and how he was able to build a completely different view. It's what he did.
He did, and he did it really efficiently. It's a very short book.
Mm-hmm.
In modern sci-fi, somebody like Neal Stephenson would take 10,000 pages to write this story.
And you could have easily used that much. I mean, you could have gone into more detail on the Knipe. You could have done flashbacks with the Knipe to help us understand his culture better. But when they sat down, and I was going to compliment you on this as well. When you were reading the segment, when Dr. Yoritomo and Bart sat down and thought through the entire Knipe and what his culture must have been like and how long it took to develop it. One of the things you did was read those two characters, which was actually a pretty dry section of the book. You made it very, very, very interesting.
Well, thanks.
I compliment you on that. But they, rather than do all this conjecture of what it may have been like on this other planet, it was from the viewpoint of Bart and Dr. Yoritomo. I thought that was an ingenious way of doing it.
Yes. And there is a danger where, you know, an action sci-fi gets real talky, but you really had to have that because that was the meat of the story, is them understanding the mentality and culture of this thing that is not understandable. And they can't understand it by contacting it, just through observation.
Was that difficult for you to read?
No, not really, because I just imagine you've got a student and a teacher, and the teacher's trying to make the student come to this conclusion that he's already reached. So how would I guide? I just imagine trying to guide a little kid through the steps to reach the right conclusion at the end. And it flowed for me.
It did. Well, to the point where I could easily visualize in my head these two men sitting down and talking. And that is difficult to do, as you probably well know, to take just that kind of dialogue and turn it into something successful. It was remarkable. Something else that I found very interesting was this book was written in 1963. Mm-hmm. And if you remember in 1963, I was fairly young, but I was still around. Television wasn't much. You had your basic three stations. This story is very much what we have today, if you think about it. Controlling the net, using the media, all of that is all stuff that we do today.
Right.
I was amazed by what he was able to do with that and how accurate he was with being able to use the media to get the Knight the information that they wanted him to have and yet keep the information that they didn't want.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't that, weren't you amazed by that? I mean,
it is something that is almost ripped out of the headlines of today. Exactly.
Yeah. The fake news.
Yes. The fake news.
He had them believing, and the Knight was believing it. And so he thought he was safe and secure in his little home. But actually, the whole time, he was a prisoner, in reality.
And never knew it.
Another ingenious thing was the use of drones in the form of the rats.
Yes, that was great.
As a narrator, a lot of times you don't get to pick what you read. But when you're working for LibriVox, you do. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes.
Why did you pick this story?
It is really unique. And it reminded me a little of a short story by Stanley Weinbaum called Martian Chronicle, where somebody on Mars meets a Martian who's simply not understandable, just not looks different, but cannot be comprehended in any manner, shape, or form, even though it's clearly intelligent. So it reminded me of that, and that's a story I recorded many years ago. It had that hook where it had the incomprehensible other who may or may not be hostile. We just do not understand it. And I thought it was so unique that it should be an audiobook.
I have a fun fact for you.
Okay.
One of the things that I was intrigued by, it was one of the interludes when Mannheim was asking Bart, are you going to do this? Bart isn't sure. He's not. He's kind of hemming and hawing. And then all of a sudden, we're in the Pirates of Penzance, reading lines from the actual Gilbert and Sullivan play. Well, you have appealed to my sense of duty, and my duty is only all too clear. I abhor your infamous calling. I shudder at the thought that I have ever been mixed up with it. But duty is before all. At any price, I will do my duty. And so I got to thinking, where did that come from? And sure enough, it's from the Pirates of Penzance, which is a comedy.
Okay. I did not know that.
Oh, you
well,
didn't?
I did know that Pirates of Penzance is a play and a comedy. I didn't know it was, honestly, until you just told me, I didn't know it was quoted in the book.
Yep. That whole scene, Dr. Yorimoto is looking on confused. They're actually quoting lines from the play to each other.
Wow.
And I love that when he said, I will do my duty. And then he signs the dotted line and create the superhuman. The last time you were on, we talked about the whole copyright issue, and I've actually had a lot of emails from people asking me how anything you can do, if it was written in 1963, how is it possible that it's public domain?
It was during an era where books had an expiration date of, I think, 28 years, and then they had to be renewed. And there were a lot of books from that late 50s to up to 1963 that, for whatever reason, they weren't renewed, and it has to be renewed in the 28th year. And if people miss that window, it goes into the public domain. And that's where this one fell.
That's interesting. And we have Project Gutenberg to thank for that, right? They were the ones that established that.
Well, yes. And they track it, and they do the research to make sure that books have not been renewed for copyright before they allow them to be published there. It's actually pretty easy to verify that a book has been renewed. It's much harder to figure out that they haven't. It's an imperfect system.
That's interesting. Well, Mark, I want to thank you so much. I want to thank you for the job you did and the passion that you put into that book. I want to thank you for coming on the show today. And if people want to find out more about what you do and find out more about your voiceover work and, of course, your narrations, where do they go to do that?
You actually go to harryshawnarrations.com. I do my professional work under a pseudonym. And that's because there's already a narrator named Mark Nelson, so I couldn't reuse the name.
Okay. And if we wanted to find your books on Audible, we would look for Harry.
You look for Harry Shaw.
And that would be you.
That would be me. That's my Audible name. And if you find a Mark Nelson, it may or may not be me. In fact, funny story, early this year, I received in the mail a certificate of award from Audiophile magazine for Mark Nelson.
Oh, yeah?
I was honored to receive, although it wasn't me.
Well, Mark, I appreciate you and I appreciate you coming on the show today.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure to be here.
That was great fun, and I want to thank Mark Nelson for coming on the podcast today. He truly is good at what he does. If you want to know more about Mark or find his work, I will have all the links for you in the show notes. Thank you, Mark.
As read by Amazing Stories, read by amazing people.
This time on As Read By, we continue growing up with Tom Williams. Tom lives in Berlin, Germany, was raised in Alabama, and has sent in these tales from his youth. This time, Tom thinks back to the days of Tom Sawyer Afternoons in a story he calls...
Growing Up, Those Tom Sawyer Days. As I sit here thinking back on my childhood, I realize that we did have those Tom Sawyer days, too, which surprises me greatly to this day. I never thought of my childhood in that manner. I remember now one of our adventures. It may not be that great to you, but for me it was a pleasant time. Of many houses we lived in, one was just off the end of the runway 18, bordering the Brooklyn Air Force Base. The base was located along the shore of the Mobile Bay. It took a few weeks getting used to those takeoff and landings over the top of our roof, but it was a nice place to live. As Fearless Fred spent a weekend with us, we got the great idea to go crabbing in the bay, about a half mile from the house. The shoreline along the Air Force Base was a playground for us anyways. Tree logs washed down the Alabama River, and hundreds of them got log jammed along the shoreline adjacent to the fence of the Air Force Base. Our fun was to walk, or rather jump, from one log to another until we reached the end and then back again, which was approximately a quarter to a half mile long. Now back to the crabs. There's nothing as good as fresh boiled crab in butter. So Fred and I went to a small grocery store where Mom always shopped and got some soup bone. With these and a homemade net made out of those plastic net bags that oranges come in, and of course enough string and bucket, we set out to the bay. It was a fantastic day weather-wise. We made our way east to the bay, crossing the railroad tracks and past the old wooden homes fenced in with barking dogs. There was an old wooden rotten wharf that jetted into the bay. Cautiously, we made our way to the end, and cutting the string into a proper length and tying the soup bones to the ends, we lowered the bait into the water and waited. Fred and I always enjoyed watching the flock of pelicans circling and then diving into the water and sometimes having trouble taking off with a craw full of fish. Soon the strings began to move. This meant that the crabs were feasting, and very slowly we raised the string high enough to barely see the crabs, and with the homemade net, we gently scooped the crabs out of the water and into the bucket. It wasn't long before we had caught a couple dozen good-sized crabs, and we couldn't wait to get home to those sweet crabs and butter. Making our way back home and almost to the old railroad tracks again and past the old houses, a man sat on his front porch. "What you boys got there?" "Well, fresh crabs, sir," we answered. "Want to sell me some?" Fred and I looked at each other with dollar signs in our eyes. "Sure, mister." And with the old dog barking at the fence, the man came to us and picked out what he wanted, and we were paid. The thing is that it didn't end there. This happened again and again, and by the time we got home, there were no crabs anymore, but a pocket full of change. And you know, the moral to this story is money was hard to come by those days, but there were plenty of crabs in the bay. Sincerely, Tom.
Thank you, Tom. As always, you bring back my memories with your stories. My father died when I was 3 years old, but in my mind, I was never without a dad. I was lucky, in a way, because I never knew him, and my mom would remarry to my dad some years later. My new dad took me to do things that were, well, amazing. One of my first memories is the day he took me smelt fishing. Smelt, like salmon, return to the river of the births to spawn, usually in mid to late winter. They generally are about 5 to 6 inches long and are caught with dip nets. I remember that this was a cold day. My dad was with his friends looking out over the snowy scene where the rush of the Cowlitz River was being outdone by the surging of millions of smelt. My dad and I walked up to the edge of the water, and I was taken aback at the sight. He took out his net and scooped out what seemed to me to be hundreds of squirming fish. Then he dumped them into a bucket, and one of his buddies would take it away. Another bucket would be placed, and the process would continue until they hit their quota. I remember just being amazed by my dad and the strength he had to dip net after net. During the whole thing, I didn't have a thing to do except stand there and watch. Well, then came the not-so-fun part when we got home. You see, we had to clean and gut every one of those fish before my dad could freeze them. Thank you for your story, Tom, and I can't wait to hear what you have for us next time. I want to thank Tom Williams and Mark Nelson for taking part in the podcast today. You guys are great. Next week, we have a podcast full of your stories that will range from a meeting with the Grim Reaper to several stories about angels. So, I'll see you next time on the podcast. If you want to follow me and the podcast, head to ronsamazingstories.com. There, you'll find every link you will need. Oh, and please leave reviews about the show. It really does make us grow. Thank you for listening, and I hope you come again to find out what are Ron's Amazing Stories.